Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Sometimes you have to dig deep to find a heartwarming story about coal these days, but sometimes you just have to remember your childhood.
And it didn't matter that he was always covered completely from head to toe in coal dirt. It didn't matter. I'd jump up in Dad's arms, and then I'd take his bucket because he always had leftovers for me.
While the food they carry down in the mines often includes something sweet to bring home as leftovers for their children, the extra food is often packed just in case something bad happens while they're at work.
You know, if you worked in the mine for years, you knew to carry a little extra just in case, you know.
And one food in West Virginia may have been invented by the wives of coal miners so they'd have something to eat that would travel well underground.
So the pepperoni roll really became this kind of portable, cheap, non-perishable lunch.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're going to hear an episode from the Inside Appalachia archives about coal miner lunch buckets. We produced it after I received a bunch of comments on Facebook when I asked people to share their stories of their dad's lunch or dinner buckets. One of the most heartwarming responses was from Jennifer Alvarez. She now lives in Mercer County and works as an attorney, but she grew up in Anstead, a coal camp town in Fayette County, West Virginia. I met up with her to talk more about lunchboxes. What did this bucket look like? I know that I remember my dad sitting on the counter, and it was silver, like the layered that had the different layers on it, you know, and it was metal. It had a few stickers on it. What did your dad's look like?
If I'm remembering correctly, I think he had one like that at one time, but then I think he also had another one that he carried that was just like a black plastic with the handle on the top and the two metal clasps on the front that just opened up and held a thermos and all of that in it. He worked mine rescue, and he had all of these different stickers from different mines and different mine rescue competitions that he'd been to and things like that. But he would come home from work, and I would run out to meet him in the driveway, and it didn't matter that he was always covered completely from head to toe in coal dirt. It didn't matter. I'd jump up in Dad's arms, and then I'd take his bucket because he always had leftovers for me. Usually his leftovers were things like Reese's cups or Hostess cakes. He'd bring the pink snowball cakes. And it took me years. Like, I always just thought that he just didn't eat all of his lunch. It took me years before I finally figured out that he stopped every day on his way home to get something for me to make sure I had something when I greeted him in the evenings.
That was Jennifer Alvarez of Mercer County, West Virginia, talking about her daddy's lunch bucket. She first shared this story with me on Facebook, and she's not alone. Several of you shared your memories of your dad's coal miner bucket. We'll hear more from Jennifer later in the show and find out why it was so important for her to share this story. But first, we want to share another story from deep down in the southern part of Appalachia, down in Alabama. For decades, Ronnie Johnson woke up in the late afternoon and fixed a lunch to bring with him 2,000 feet underground as he worked on the Hoot Owl shift all night in a coal mine. Ronnie grew up in a small community in northwest Alabama where many people work in nearby mines. His son Caleb remembers his father's lunchtime ritual. He told his story in an episode of the Gravy Podcast. Let's have a listen.
My dad woke up every day at 5 in the evening. He walked out back, smoked a cigarette, and drank a Dr. Pepper. A rotating cast of yard dogs vied for his attention while he listened to local sports talk radio. Only once this ritual was complete could he come into the kitchen and start another one, fixing his lunch. He tore loose a few paper towels and spread them on the counter. Then he set down his metal lunchbox and opened the lid. As far back as I can remember, it was covered in heavy-duty vinyl stickers and smudged by industrial grease and coal dust. In the refrigerator, there might be a container of vegetable soup his mama, my granny, had cooked the Saturday before. If not, he'd just as soon eat a few bologna sandwiches. Letting a slice turn black in a pan was as close to cooking as I ever saw him get. He wrapped these sandwiches in foil, then stacked them in the lunchbox like a deck of cards. He'd eat around 4 a.m., in a tunnel nearly 1,800 feet underground. Dad left our house in Arley, Alabama for his job at Jim Walter Resources No. 7 mine in Brookwood while my mama's sister and I were still eating dinner. Six times a week, he made this four-hour round-trip commute to work what's called the owl shift, from 11 p.m. to 9 a.m. So we didn't see Dad much during the week, but there was always that little bit of time when he stood at the counter fixing his lunch. Sometimes we talked, sometimes I just watched. He worked with the same care and intent, and maybe just a little of the same superstition that I imagine he did down in the mine. This past spring, my dad retired. We'll get around to why later. But suddenly, he was without this evening ritual. He no longer had to prepare for a long night in the mine, but instead had to get ready for the rest of his life without it. My dad's never been introspective, but I thought talking about his lunchbox and the food he carried in it for so many years might get him to reflect and help me better understand the role coal has played in our lives.
Okay, my name is Ronnie Johnson. I'm 63 years old. I worked at three different coal mines for a total of 35 years and 2 months.
He didn't start out wanting to be a coal miner. In 1979, Dad was working as a dispatcher for a company in Double Springs that delivered mobile homes. In June of that year, many long-haul truckers went on strike to protest soaring diesel fuel prices. When the company hired strikebreakers, things escalated.
They called in a bomb threat to the office. They said they were going to blow the office up. You better get all of us out of there.
Work was canceled. Dad went to softball practice later that afternoon.
Well, I was playing softball for a team in Carbon Hill at the time, and Carbon Hill's in Walker County, and that's predominantly coal country.
Baseball and softball have long been part of coal communities. Several of Dad's teammates even worked in local mines. One of them started talking to him about it.
He said, "Why don't you get you a job in the coal mines?" I said, "Why don't you get me a job in the coal mines?"
Working in a coal mine was one of the best paying jobs around for somebody who, like my dad, didn't have a college degree. So he turned in an application. Summer passed, the trucker strike ended, and softball season too. He went back to work as a dispatcher and didn't think much about the mines until one day, in February 1980, his mama called the office.
And so I got on the phone, and mother said, what have you done? And I said, you know, back then there's no telling what I had done. So I said, I don't know, what have I done? And she said, there's a lady named Miss Love called here from Maxine Mines, and they want you to come down for an interview.
A couple days later, he was offered a job. Coal has been a part of life in Alabama for almost 200 years. A group of veterans headed home from the Battle of New Orleans discovered coal in central Alabama around 1820. Dr. Jim Day is a historian at the University of Montevallo. He says these soldiers stumbled on coal by accident.
A couple of boys were out wandering the woods one afternoon, built a fire, and went to sleep. Woke up and the rocks were on fire. So that was kind of the legendary start of coal.
It took another 20 years before somebody opened a real working mine. These early operations tended to be small and individually owned, and the operators lacked the knowledge, money, and machinery to do much more than blast away exposed coal seams in riverbanks or dig out whatever was near the surface. Then, an English engineer named Joseph Squire showed up in central Alabama. Before long, open pit mining gave way to drift and slope mining, which followed coal seams deeper underground. Mule-drawn wagons, rail lines, and later electric pulleys were used to carry coal up to the surface. Squire wasn't the only immigrant coming to work in the Alabama mines either.
Coal mining really brought a lot of European immigrants to this area.
Italians, Hungarians, Romanians, poor whites, and blacks who'd left the agrarian black belt during Reconstruction also joined them underground. They all brought with them food traditions and carried their meals in cylindrical metal lunchboxes. In the bottom would go fresh water to drink, which also kept the food cool. Next would be a removable tray filled with the main course. Maybe a chunk of pork, some other meat, or a sandwich. On top would go a dessert. I've got a man in the palm of mine. Underground rock falls and explosions were common, so a well-packed lunch could mean the difference between life and death while miners waited to be rescued. The heyday of Alabama coal mining was the 1920s. During World War I, the Navy needed lots of cheap fuel to power its ships. Jim estimates anywhere between 50 to 100 mines operated at a given time across the state's four coal fields. Alabama coal heated houses, powered locomotives, and fed blast furnaces in Birmingham's booming steel industry. Tens of thousands of workers depended on coal mining, directly or indirectly, and in less than a century, coal had forever altered the state's economy, its landscape, and culture.
My experience indicates that folks who live in Alabama only need to go back one generation or two to find some connection to coal. And that, I think that story resonates with a lot of people.
Dad's coal story begins at the Maxine mine. Its ceiling was only 36 inches high, not much taller than most desks. The miners wore knee pads to protect themselves while crawling. Maxine only went about 300 feet below ground, not very deep compared to the shaft mines Dad would later work in.
I even saw a copperhead in that mine. That's how shallow that mine was.
A snake wasn't the only wildlife he saw either, and eating lunch could be tricky with the critters that lived underground. Dad remembers one particular encounter. He crawled into a ram car, a vehicle that hauls coal, on his lunch break.
So I got my lunch bucket in there with me and opened it up and got me out a bologna and cheese sandwich and took my hard hat off because I was hot. And I was eating my bologna and cheese sandwich and I kept hearing a noise to the left of me. It sounded like a hog or something in it. So I eased my right hand up there and got my hard hat and shined it down beside the shuttle car. And there was a huge gopher rat, had his feet, front feet up on the side of the shuttle car trying to get to my bologna and cheese sandwich. And I panicked and started swatting at him, and he ran off. But we didn't have mice at Maxine. We had gopher rats as big as a house cat. You know, they were huge. They would scare you to death when you run up on them.
The rats survived on food scraps, but the miners actually depended on the rats, too, on their ability to sense when a ceiling was about to collapse.
You would see those rats, like, line up and just start running. And when you saw them start running, you knew you better start running, too. And if you don't think you can get up and run in 36-inch coal, you're crazy, because you can when that top starts coming in bad enough. Now, you might have some scant places on your back by the time you get out of there, but you can get up and run.
Dad was laid off from Maxine after about a year. Then he was hired at Nebo Mine. When it shut down, he was laid off again. Then, in 1984, he was called to work at Jim Walter Resources No. 7 Mine, just east of Tuscaloosa. I was born 2 years later. The No. 7 mine was much deeper than others he'd worked at. At nearly 1,800 feet, it's one of the deepest vertical shafts in North America. 59 miners at a time rode an elevator down to the bottom, where more rats waited in the darkness.
Little rats, little mice, they would eat your lunch too if you didn't hang it up, you know. That's one reason I went to a metal lunch bucket.
After the 3-minute elevator ride, the miners walked maybe 100 yards to what they called the man bus, which carried them on a track to their sections.
Starting out, it might not take you 15 minutes to get to where you worked at in 1984, but by the time I left working on a section in 2013, it was taking me an hour.
Dad started out operating the ram car. This machine carries coal to a feeder, which dumps it onto a conveyor belt and sends it outside. Eating in the No. 7 mine was slightly more pleasant than in Maxine or Nebo. For one, the ceiling was closer to 6 or 7 feet tall. Dad's lunches consisted mostly of sandwiches.
I brought bologna and cheese most of the time. Sometimes banana sandwiches, you know, but mainly bologna and cheese or ham and cheese, you know, something like that. Just kind of swap it around.
Then, in the 90s, the miners finally figured out a trick that changed the kinds of food they could bring to work. It involved the mine's power center. Think of it like an enormous underground generator. When all the machinery and the lights were running, the power center would get hot.
We just learned, you know, to bring Tupperware bowls and put on top of that power center. Like if you had spaghetti or if you had soup or, you know, whatever you had, and chili, whatever. And you would cover it up with a lid, and by the time you got to eat lunch at 3:30 or 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning, then your food was usually pretty warm.
Dad still doesn't know what took him so long to come up with this idea. His mama cooked for him once a week. He preferred her cooking to his wife's. Corned beef hash with boiled cabbage, vegetable soup, big lima beans with ground beef, pork chops, even hamburger patties. and always a slice or two of cornbread.
It was just like, homemade stuff. It wasn't out of a can,
Eventually, regulations changed, and a microwave was allowed down in number 7, making it easier for the miners to enjoy a hot meal. An Alabama coal mine was a dangerous and unpredictable place to work. Dad saw 40 fires break out during his career, an average of at least one a year. He lost half a finger in an accident. Eating home-cooked meals in such a volatile place brought him and the other miners comfort and familiarity. It helped them get through long, grueling shifts. But over the years, as fast food culture grew in mainstream America and the South, it moved underground too. Dad watched a generation of miners retire, men who, like him, brought home-cooked meals. And he noticed changes in the food these younger workers carried underground.
They just buy them some potato chips and crackers and buy in a sausage or cookies or something and throw it in a grocery bag. Well, it was just a different generation.
Some coal miners have long eaten processed foods, though. You know the moon pie? Two round graham cracker cookies stuffed with marshmallow filling and dipped into a flavored icing. According to the Chattanooga Bakery, the moon pie was created in 1917 when a Kentucky coal miner asked for a snack as big as the moon, framing the yellow orb with his hands so the traveling salesman knew exactly how big he meant. Even Dad would sometimes bring a nutty bar or an oatmeal cream pie in his lunchbox. Still, he and other veteran miners gave out nicknames poking fun at those who carried store-bought food in plastic bags. One guy became Food World, another guy Subway. Food was used to create a pecking order. The miners all made good money, but not all of them had a mama or a wife to stay home and cook for them, or the know-how to cook for themselves. And besides, doling out nicknames like these was mild compared to the hazing when Dad started working in the number 7 mine. His first year, some veteran miners told him it was tradition to bring a cake on your birthday.
They just jumped up and lit in on me and said, if you don't bring a birthday cake, we're going to grease you.
So his wife, my mama, baked 2 yellow cakes, then whipped up some homemade chocolate icing. She was ready to spread it on when Dad stopped her. He had a box of X-Lax in his hand. The stuff that makes you, let's say, regular. She asked what on earth he was doing with that.
And I said, don't matter. Don't worry about what I'm doing. I'm going to teach some people a lesson.
He had on hand not one box, but 2.
I said, what the heck? So I just went back over and got the other box and dumped it in there too.
The next day, he carried balloons, party hats, noisemakers, and both cakes down into the mine.
I said, now here's y'all's birthday cake. So they loaded in on it. I mean, they went wild on it.
Of the 11-man crew, only 4 showed up for work that next day.
I worked there 34 more years after that, and they never asked me to bring another birthday cake after that time.
After a stint on the ram car, Dad operated the roof bolt machine, which secures the ceiling with steel rods. He spent more than 20 years doing this. Then he moved to the long wall, which is a machine that shears coal from the wall face. Beauty might not be a word you'd imagine being used to describe anything in a coal mine, but there were moments of it among all that dust and darkness. After the coal had been cut away, Dad would sometimes see fossils exposed in the rock. The remains of ferns, leaves from ancient trees. He became a collector, carrying smaller ones home in his lunchbox. These fossils are strewn around my parents' house, in flower beds, and on the back porch where Dad still sits and smokes. He gave a piece of a fossilized tree to my girlfriend when she first visited Alabama. A good sign, I knew.
You just like take a hammer, maybe, and peck at them or whatever. Sometimes they broke, sometimes they fell on their own, and you got lucky.
He'll never forget one sighting in 2004. The ceiling had partially collapsed on the long wall, and the crew needed to drill the machine free. In doing so, they discovered a vast chamber nearly 2,000 feet underground. They looked up to see how high it went.
And you couldn't see nothing but forest. It was just like a forest. Full trees laying lapped over the top of each other, like it had come a tornado or something, but they were petrified. And I imagine some of them were probably 40 foot long or longer.
But all they could do was look. As the long wall moved, the ceiling collapsed behind it. burying the entrance to that enormous chamber of petrified trees.
We got to see it as something, you know, not many people ever see and ever or ever will see again.
His last position at Number 7 Mine was in an underground office operating the hoist, which carries coal to the surface.
You know, that was the easiest job I ever had, you know.
He brought the same lunches in the same lunchbox. It was just a little more enjoyable to eat while sitting upright in a comfortable chair. Dad was 61 years old when he transferred to this position. After more than 30 years working in the coal mines, he was, all in all, in good health. My sister had started college down the road in Tuscaloosa. Dad planned to work until she graduated, maybe longer now that he wasn't on his feet all night long. Then, in 2015, a rumor that had been going around for a couple years suddenly became reality.
Walter Energy filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in July and has laid off hundreds of employees since.
We've been listening to a story by Caleb Johnson. In a minute, we'll hear what happened to his family when his father had to hang up his lunch bucket.
Most all of us older miners knew that they didn't care anything about you because we'd done seen how they did their own people, their company people. So we knew they sure didn't care anything about the union, the working man.
That's coming up next. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
For 30-odd years, Daddy worked underground and carried his dinner bucket. It was dented and scarred from mine cars in Rock Falls, he avoided. He was proud to be earning a living. He didn't take a dime from no one.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're listening to Inside Appalachia. Today we're talking about the food miners bring with them to work in their miner's bucket. Now let's pick it back up with Caleb Johnson to hear what happened to his father when the coal company he worked for shut down.
The Alabama coal industry first began to decline during the stock market crash in 1929. Over the years, competition from other fuel sources drove down prices even more. Whole towns built on mining just disappeared. Dr. Jim Day, remember him, the professor from the University of Montevallo? He calls coal Alabama's hidden history. It often takes some poking around to understand how important the industry has been to the state.
By the mid-1950s, many of those slopes that had been opened in the 20s and the 30s were obsolete. Much of the coal that was easy to get was depleted. The mines had been mined out, as they say, and to go any deeper would have just been too expensive. Many of those mines closed and went elsewhere.
One company that stayed was Walter Energy, which owned Jim Walter Resources, where my dad worked. For the last 15 or 20 years, the company mined metallurgical coal, which has a higher carbon content than thermal coal. Met coal burns hotter and is primarily used in steel production. Much of the coal my dad mined in central Alabama was shipped to China. Then, in 2015, China's coal consumption fell off for the first time in more than a decade. In mid-July that same year, Walter Energy filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, with $5 billion in debts. Hundreds of miners were laid off that summer, and hundreds more in the months that followed. But nothing changed immediately for my dad. He'd worked there longer than 95% of the other miners. That meant Number 7 would have to completely shut down before he was laid off. This didn't seem likely. The Blue Creek seam could be mined for many, many more years without being tapped out. So Dad continued his evening ritual, fixing his lunch, making that four-hour round-trip commute to the mine, and a long descent into its depths. For months, my family, like many others, worried what would happen next. When Walter Energy filed for bankruptcy, it ended its labor agreement with the United Mine Workers of America. What would happen to the miners' health insurance, to their retirement packages in the meantime, and when a new company finally took over? Dad wasn't hopeful, but he waited to find out what the new agreement would look like before making a final decision on his future. He got an answer one morning in the dead of winter. The company and the union had agreed to an initial new labor deal.
Came home and then I got some phone calls the next day saying they were voting on the new contract and telling all the cuts and all that was being done. And so I said, I can't live with all those cuts.
He blames the union. Its leadership, he says, didn't hold the company accountable. And the company, he says...
Most all of us older miners knew that they didn't care anything about you because we'd done seen how they did their own people, their company people. So we knew they sure didn't care anything about the union, the working man.
When he filed his paperwork, saying he'd rather retire than stay on with the cuts in pay and benefits, the company offered him a chance to walk through the mine one last time, for old time's sake.
I just told him I didn't even want to do that. You know, I was through with it.
After all those years, I wondered how could he not? Did he not feel nostalgic? Did he not want to snuff out any lingering doubt or future regret? Dad framed it as being a more practical matter than that.
I just didn't want to have to drive all the way back down there, you know, to go through that. I just didn't want to, you know.
On February 19th, 2016, he went to get his boots and belt and hard hat from his locker. His lunchbox was already at home. He saw a few coworkers that day. I asked what they talked about. Nothing, he said. Small talk. They told him good luck. Until I started writing this story, I'd never asked my dad if he thought of himself as a coal miner, or if he was proud of the work he did.
Coal miners, most people believe the coal dust get in their lungs, you know, and cause black lungs and all. But when you ran coal, that coal dust got in your blood. It's what you wanted to do. Like if the day shift ran 100 foot, you wanted to run 105 foot. And if the evening shift ran 110 foot, you wanted to run 115 foot. It got in your blood. It was like a four quarters of a football game. Whoever did best, you know, like they won that day is what it was like between each other. So the coal dust, we always said, didn't only get in your lungs. Running coal got in your blood too, you know, because it's something you wanted to do and loved to do.
In my early 20s, I got my first tattoo. I was just about to finish college, and I remember coming home afterward and holding out my right arm for Dad to see. A tunnel, a hammer and a chisel across its entrance, and above that, a banner reading Blue Creek, the seam of coal he mined, and the number 7. Dad did little more than grunt and take a sip of Dr. Pepper. But later that night, he told his coworkers about my tattoo. If I was 30 years younger, he said to me the next day, I might get me one like that. I got this tattoo to honor my dad, and in doing so, I wound up honoring coal, the mining and burning of which allowed my dad to help pay for my college education. It was there at college in Tuscaloosa, just a 15-minute drive from the number 7 mine, where I began questioning our country's undying dedication to fossil fuels. I was introduced to liberal politics that just did not exist in my small conservative community. To my dad's disappointment, I voted for Obama, twice. When I talk to my dad about coal now, I hear anger in his voice. This anger, I think, is symptomatic of what a recent study by Princeton economists calls an epidemic of despair among middle-aged, uneducated white Americans. I fear this despair will only grow as more and more workers, like my dad, are left behind by a changing economy and culture. I'm not exactly against this kind of change. From my remove of college-educated comfort, I can see how easy it might be to applaud another nail driven into coal's coffin. But for my family, it's more complicated than that. I've tried to ask my dad how it feels to be a man forced to confront such unwieldy forces as globalization. He just doesn't think in those terms. Same as he never thought about the toll mining took on his body.
No, I never thought about that. I was thinking about raising my family, you know. It was a good job, you know, a good paying job, so that's the only way I looked at it, you know.
But that isn't the entire truth. There's still coal in his blood. This unexpected retirement has been hard on him. I ask what he misses most about the mine.
Having a place to go every day, you know.
And every night, an evening ritual, carrying a lunchbox filled with a home-cooked meal, the community of men he spent more hours with each week than he did with his own family. Now, all this unfilled time. I never imagined Dad would retire. He's still deciding what this new role looks like for him.
Well, I work in my yard. You know, around here there's always sticks and limbs to pick up, and I got me a new weed eater, so I've been weed eating some and working in my garden some and piddling on my truck some, just, and then, you know, I listen to a lot of sports talk shows too, you know, sitting on the back porch. It's not nothing like I expected. It's real boring. I really don't enjoy it at all, you know.
He visits his mama a few times each week. She's a cancer survivor and can't see well anymore. She doesn't cook as often as she used to, but on Saturdays, she still wakes up early and fixes a big meal. He eats and visits, then brings home the leftovers in Tupperware containers and heats them up throughout the week in a microwave. He eats now in front of the television or on the back porch while the dogs beg for scraps. His lunchbox sits in the garage alongside his hard hat and light. One day they'll belong to me, he says, a worker's tools becoming a writer's keepsakes. Last time I was home, I asked him to take out his lunchbox. It looks better suited to carrying wrenches than sandwiches or soup.
It's got stickers, naturally. You know me, I've got Alabama Crimson Tide stickers all over mine. And then regular coal mine stickers, too. We collected stickers over the years, coal mine stickers, you know, you put on your hard hat.
I asked what was inside.
There's nothing on the inside now. I took everything out.
But Dad can still tell you the things he used to carry.
I always kept Cherry Skull, ibuprofen, Oragel, maybe a pair of fingernail clippers, and then the rest of it was food, you know.
Each night, he carried a little something extra, too.
A little extra food, maybe a can of Vienna sausage and crackers or something, just in case you always had the possibility of getting trapped in the mines.
I never realized the purpose of these snacks he'd sometimes offer me when he got home in the morning. The leftovers in his lunchbox. I never really imagined anything bad could happen to Dad down there in the mine. He didn't make a big deal about what he did every night. But he always knew the reality of it.
It was a possibility, so, you know, if you worked in the mine for years, you knew to carry a little extra just in case, you know.
Caleb Johnson is an Alabama native. He currently lives in Philadelphia, where he teaches reading and writing at a middle school and is working on writing a novel. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. What's one food everybody in West Virginia knows, but hardly anyone outside of our region has ever tasted? Pepperoni rolls, of course. You may remember last year when a chain of convenience stores called Sheetz got itself in big trouble by announcing they were going to start selling pepperoni rolls made in Pennsylvania. Pepperoni rolls have been called the unofficial food of West Virginia. They were invented here in the Mountain State, and legend has it they were originally made for coal miners to take underground in their dinner buckets because the cured pepperoni didn't spoil. A new book about pepperoni rolls is set to be published next year. Roxy Todd, as we know, is a huge fan of pepperoni rolls, so she had a chat with the writer of this new book to learn more.
Candace Nelson is a writer based out of Morgantown, West Virginia, and she's writing a book called The West Virginia Pepperoni Roll. Candace, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about your first experience and memory with pepperoni rolls.
Sure. I mean, my first experience with the pepperoni roll goes way back. I remember, especially in high school, we actually had them as fundraisers. So our marching band would sell them, and we'd run out at lunchtime to go buy a pepperoni roll for lunch instead of whatever the cafeteria may have been serving. And that was pretty common to me. And I didn't realize that pepperoni rolls were unique to West Virginia until I actually moved to Morgantown and met folks who are from, you know, states surrounding West Virginia. And they had never heard of a pepperoni roll. And my first question was, well, what did you sell for fundraisers in high school? And of course, they thought that was silly. There's a lot of other things that you can sell. But it was just so part of my experience that I didn't even entertain the thought that others didn't share that. So high school is when I really participated in the whole pepperoni roll sale, because they were larger than the traditional pepperoni roll. They were a whole meal. And they had sauce and sliced pepperoni, which I know is sacrilege in some parts of the state. But they were great, you know, filled with warm cheese, and they really constituted an entire meal, whereas some of the more traditional ones are smaller and more of a snack.
So do you share those with somebody else, or you eat it all to yourself?
So we're probably supposed to share them with someone else. I'm not sure that I did that, because I remember them being, and they, I think maybe still to this day, they might be my favorite ones. But it was definitely one of my fun memories from high school, rushing out of our second or third class for the day and trying to get in line so you could get yours first. But yeah, I think those still remain probably my favorite pepperoni rolls.
It sounds delicious. I need to try one of those. So tell me, as you started researching this book and talking to people about their memories of the pepperoni roll, what are some of the stories you have been hearing?
Oh, goodness. There are so many good stories. And I think the thing that's really cool about the pepperoni roll is that it's more than just a food to so many people. It's what they associate with tailgating for their first, you know, football games, or the snacks that they had at picnics or school trips, or it's really much more than just this food. It's more tied to their memory, which is pretty cool.
And I know it's kind of ambiguous who invented the pepperoni roll. It's kind of this question that's unanswerable in some ways. What did you find out when you asked people who invented the pepperoni roll?
So the creation of the pepperoni roll is as much utilitarian as it is culinary. And Chris Pallotta, the current owner of Country Club Bakery, which is the one that's widely credited with the invention of the pepperoni roll, said that Giuseppe Argiro, who emigrated from Calabria, Italy, to work in the coal mines in north central West Virginia, was looking for an easier way to eat lunch in the mines. And he knew his fellow Italians would often bring water and a stick of pepperoni or salami and a roll for lunch. So what Giuseppe did sometime around 1927 was combine the pepperoni and the bread into the pepperoni roll so you can eat it with one hand and drink with the other. So the pepperoni roll really became this kind of portable, cheap, non-perishable lunch. And it's likely that someone somewhere, maybe even into Western PA, may have made this in a home kitchen somewhere. We don't know that for sure. But we do know that Giuseppe is the one who's credited with commercializing it, and that's how it helped take off.
And we've been hearing on our show today a lot about the food that miners would take down into the mines and the food that their wives would pack for them often. And, you know, it seems that the pepperoni rolls ties right into that. This is food that was utilitarian, as you say, food that wouldn't go bad on a long shift down in the mines. It's interesting to me that probably, in my mind, wives or women maybe invented this just to give to their husbands. But like many things, men kind of commercialized it.
I think that's very likely the case. We know that Giuseppe commercialized it. But if we think back to who was actually packing those lunches at that point in time, it was definitely the wives. The men were going down into these mines and working very long days. And to have something that is simple and non-perishable, and it's easier and quicker for them to eat so they can get back to work. You know, they're trying to make life a little bit easier and make something that's this one-handed lunch where they can drink in one hand, eat in the other, and get back to work.
And when we talk about pepperoni rolls and I explain it to people for the first time, sometimes people say, I don't get it. It's a stick of pepperoni. It's some white bread. What's the big deal? There's a lot of nostalgia and, you know, like childhood memories wrapped into it. But just in a culinary way, there's something magical that happens when the grease of the pepperoni gets into the bread. And it's just, it's indescribable what the magic is. How do you describe why it's so popular in West Virginia?
I think part of the reason for the pepperoni roll's popularity is that it's this really homegrown meal for us here in the state. We don't have a lot of meals that we've actually created here. We have a lot of meals that, you know, we're known for or are our favorites. But as far as the pepperoni roll goes, we actually made this here. And I think we take a lot of pride in that. It's pretty simple. Like you said, there's the dough, there's the pepperoni. But I know that the folks down at Abruzzino's in Gypsy, West Virginia, he mentioned how customers will come in and actually turn over the bags of pepperoni rolls to see which one has that kind of orangish grease that has kind of seeped out, that those spices and the oils from the pepperoni kind of consume the bread and make it this really tasty snack. I think when a lot of people think that it's just dough and pepperoni, you're not giving as much credit, because you have to think when there's something special that happens when it goes in the oven and the pepperoni emits those spices and those herbs and those oils, and it infuses with the dough to create something that's really, really delicious.
When you were doing this research, did you talk to people who have moved out of the state who just long for pepperoni rolls, who beg? You know, there's all these groups of people that ask their relatives to mail them pepperoni rolls.
I have. That's actually a big part of the book. There are a few people who have craved pepperoni rolls so much that they've created their own recipe to sort of mimic their favorites from back home. So there are West Virginians out in the Pacific Northwest, Tennessee. I have folks from all over who have a recipe that they've either tried to recreate from their favorite bakery, or it might even be something that has been passed down through their family. I know folks who have had them at their weddings. I know that's been important. You know, it really is just a part of the culture. And I think it's so representative of who we are as West Virginians to have this sort of homegrown snack that we're proud of, that was created here, that is born from the coal mines, just as our history is. And it's something that we take great pride in.
Candace Nelson is author of The West Virginia Pepperoni Roll, a book coming out next spring. You can pre-order it from WVU Press. Thanks, Candace, so much for talking with me about pepperoni rolls. Now I'm truthfully very hungry for lunch.
Thank you so much for having me.
Last year, Roxy visited the bakery that's credited for having invented the pepperoni roll. From the Inside Appalachia Archives, here's the taste of her visit.
Even before you walk through the front door, the smells are pretty enticing. Fresh pepperoni baked into white Italian bread, mixed with the sweetness of fresh chocolate cookies, all cooling on the racks. That's what greets you as you walk inside. A big glass counter full of pepperoni rolls fills the room.
Who do you see come in to get pepperoni rolls?
All different types of people from all different states.
That's Marge Jarrett behind the counter.
I just had people just left here that never had them before come back in and got more.
Beside Marge, pepperoni rolls are on display behind glass. Behind that are shelves of cookies, all fresh out of the oven. On the wall are framed newspaper clippings that tell history of the first pepperoni rolls, which date back to the late 20s or early 30s. The first owner of this bakery supposedly invented them and sold them to coal miners.
Miners took bread and pepperoni, and then they'd bite pepperoni, take a bite of bread, and so he decided to do pepperoni rolls.
Pat Carr and his brother Larry walk in the door. Pat still lives here in Fairmont, but Larry is visiting from California, and he just had to make a stop on his way to the airport to buy 2 dozen pepperoni rolls.
Looking forward to getting these home and put some sauce and cheese on them and throw them in the oven, and they'll be perfect. It's the only place you can get them is right here, and these are the best.
Larry remembers smelling these pepperoni rolls baking even from the road.
Every time you drive by here, you could smell them, and that just drew you right into the parking lot. I remember that as a child, driving by here. The windows were open, and you could smell the fresh pepperoni buns coming out of the oven.
His brother Pat says the simple, Spartan look to this bakery is part of its charm.
When Larry and I were a kid, came here, and I was just telling Larry when we got out of the car, I said, it looks exactly the same, but it's well kept. It's a neat place.
But the most important thing about pepperoni rolls, according to the Carr brothers, is this. Again, here's Larry.
I mean, there are several people that make pepperoni rolls, but Most of them don't use the sticks like you use here. They use slices of pepperoni, and I think the sticks are much better.
Most of the pepperoni rolls that are sold at gas stations and in supermarkets, those all pretty much use round, flat slices of pepperoni. The doors of the Country Club bakery seem to revolve with a constant flow of pepperoni roll customers. Janet Living grew up in nearby Ida Mae, one of the former coal camps in Marion County.
I've been eating them for like probably 60-some years, and so I love them. This bakery's been here for a lot of years, and it's very special.
The dough for the pepperoni rolls was all mixed early this morning and set to rise. The head baker, Misty Whiteman, begins the process at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I eat them, not a lot, but when they smell really good coming out of the oven, yes, they do starve me to death.
But Misty's favorite way to eat the pepperoni rolls?
I like them with a garden tomato on them and Miracle Whip. Yeah.
Misty doesn't look like someone who's been stuffing herself with pepperoni rolls. She's small but strong. She's been working here for 34 years, and she insists on doing all the heavy lifting of the flour sacks herself.
Well, you get used to it after a while. You do it every day, yes. Yeah. They always say, you ought to get them boys to do it. And I said, nope. Them boys ain't here. Who's going to do it? So, and if I'm not built up to do it, then I can't do it. You don't get bored. Right now, and it's very, very busy with the heat and the humidity. You're lucky that you get to turn around and sit down maybe 5 minutes.
Back near the ovens, it is very hot. Misty's used to it, but I'm sweating.
This is where we bake the pepperoni buns in this oven here. The pepperoni buns and buns, and over there's the bread, cookies, pies, is in that one.
And when the pepperoni rolls are baking at 500 degrees, Misty says it probably gets well over 100 degrees in this room. She doesn't know exactly because the thermometers max out at 105 degrees. The Country Club Bakery is very small. It feels like a real kitchen in somebody's home. Someone comes in every day to cut the pepperoni by hand, and the machine they use overlooks a green lawn. Light from the huge windows shines everywhere. Misty agrees with the customers we heard from earlier. She doesn't like those pepperoni rolls that come from convenience stores because they don't even compare to one of these warm pepperoni rolls right out of the oven.
Very good. Yeah, way different. They're a lot better. Fresh.
Misty is one of about 10 employees here. Together, they bake about 300 dozen pepperoni rolls a day, all right here in this one oven.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
I can get 20 pans in that oven. 45 dozen.
And like when pepperoni rolls were first invented, they're often eaten as a meal unto themselves by lots of people here in West Virginia.
And then when the summertime, when it's real hot, everybody gets pepperoni buns because you don't have to cook them. They're all done. Make a sandwich. I mean, it's a good meal.
That was Misty Whiteman, who bakes pepperoni rolls at the Country Club Bakery in Fairmont. Needless to say, Roxy didn't leave the bakery without buying a few pepperoni rolls that day. So I'd like to know, what's your favorite way to eat pepperoni rolls? Or if you've moved away, what do you do to satisfy your pepperoni roll cravings? Tell us your story on Twitter at InAppalachia. Today, yeah, we did an entire show about coal miners' buckets and the food that often goes into them. Around here, it's an important part of the everyday life, even if it has to remain a memory. For many families, the extra food that was packed away in these dinner buckets was practical. It would be there just in case an accident happened while they were at work. Returning home safely meant they could give those extra goodies to their children. They worked a lot, so taking as many moments as possible to say, "I love you," was important. It's hard to explain if you don't know what it's like to see your father go off to work as a miner, or what it's like to find out one day that you won't see him return home ever again. You see, it's more than just the dinner bucket or the food that's in it. It's the love that comes with it. It's our daddy that carried it, or our mama that kept it full of the things he left on the day that he didn't come home from work. I wanted to return to something my friend Jennifer Alvarez said about her memories of her father's lunch bucket. Remember, we heard from her at the top of the show. For Jennifer, it was another opportunity to remember her father.
Well, my dad passed away very suddenly when I was 23. He was all of 43 years old, and he died of a heart attack. And occasionally I'll see something like that that'll just spark a memory and of just what a good dad he was. And like, I think we were really lucky. And I think there are a lot of people in West Virginia who have these same memories because they were hard workers, they were good providers, and they loved us more than anything. So if I could share that with people, then great.
And his legacy lives on with you and with those memories and stories.
Well, and I definitely try for his legacy to live on. I try to make sure my kids know who he was. My oldest was only 5 when he died, and my middle one was 10 days old. And so, and then my youngest, of course, never knew him at all. So I've tried really hard to share memories that I have of him with them and to try to keep him alive that way.
What would you say is one of the strongest memories that you have of your dad? I mean, obviously, this is a pretty strong one, but if you could share anything with our audience about your dad that would help explain who he was, what would it be?
Well, my dad was incredibly friendly. One of the things I always remember about my dad is, like, we would go on vacation and he would be talking to people on, do you know them? I do now. he would always find other West Virginians because, you know, that's not hard to do when you go to Myrtle Beach. You can always find other West Virginians there, and we'd be friends with them by the end of the week. He was just very outgoing. And I mean, so when he died, people would come up to me at the wake and the funeral and just like, you don't know me, but when your dad worked in Moundsville, he helped replace my bathroom floor. And I just wanted to come down here and let you guys know that, you know, he did these things for us. And so to say I have one memory of dad would just be, he was not a big man. He was actually shorter than me when, by the time I grew to my full height, he was only about 5'6". He was small, and he had a fiery temper. He'd back me up and do whatever he needed to do for me. And he was just a great guy.
What kind of things did he try to instill in you? What was important to him, do you think?
I think the main thing that was important for him, for me, was to get my education. Absolutely, like, he would have sacrificed his last anything to make sure that I got through college. He was there backing me up through law school. I mean, it was, get your education, do better than me. Just make your life easier than mine has been. And the other thing that I think he instilled in me the most is to help. Just help people. Get out there, do what you can for other people. Don't ask for anything in return. Just give what you can.
That was Jennifer Alvarez of Mercer County, West Virginia, remembering her father. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Gravy Podcast. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, Blue Dot Sessions, and Ralph Stanley II with his song about the significance of a coal miner's lunch bucket. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.